And next is in the matter of Madeline M. Marzano-Lesnovich. If counsel could please step forward. And Justice Solomon is participating in this matter. They would please have appearances.
Chief Justice Darrell Filsonstein, Assistant Ethics Counsel from the Office of Attorney Ethics.
Good afternoon. Patrick Minter from Donnelly, Minter and Kelly on behalf of the respondent.
Good afternoon, Justices. Dave Blackwell, also from Donnelly, Minter and Kelly on behalf of the respondent.
Mr. Felsenstein.
Thank you, Judge.
May it please the court, Chief Justice, Associate Justices. This matter comes before this court by way of an order to show cause pursuant to Rule 1:20-16B. The Office of Attorney Ethics relies upon its responding brief filed on October 31, 2022, but to highlight a few areas, hopefully without repeating too much of what has already been submitted. Respondents' violations of the Rules of Professional Conduct occurred in 2004. The remoteness of respondents' transgressions, unfortunately, do not weigh more heavily than the aggravating factors, which run deep even now, 18 years later. As set forth in the OAE's responding brief, the passage of time cannot by itself serve as a heavily weighted mitigating factor. How can the mere passage of time, without a real appreciation of what transpired and what was done in violation of the rules, really mean anything at all? Multiple cases, in the same cases, have been cited by the respondent and the OAE for different propositions. Respondent for the proposition that so many years have passed and there have been no other violations, and the OAE with the position that without remorse, an understanding of the deviations, the public can only be protected with discipline that speaks to the gravity of the transgression and the harm caused, which here can never be adequately redressed. In re Hoffman, in re Kotak, and in re Pena, are all cases that both sides cited that dealt with the remoteness of the misconduct. But in each of those cases, true, time had passed. But there, respondents were either newer attorneys whose violations did not cause client harm, and there was remorse. Here, respondent, as was her right, defended herself in the malpractice action, which wound its way through the courts for years. And then respondent defended herself for years on the disciplinary charges. And she was found by clear and convincing evidence at the panel level and then again at the DRB to have shown no remorse for her violations. And now respondent tries to tell this court that she is truly remorseful. But in actuality, respondent still tries to play it both ways, arguing that she was a longtime attorney in matrimonial and family matters. Certainly, from the OAE's perspective, she should have certainly understood why a child's passport was being held in the first place. But her attorney writes in his brief, she was, quote, arguably mistaken, end of quotes, and, quote, with a sincere belief that she was doing nothing wrong, end of quotes. Respondent has just not simply admitted without qualification that she breached the rules of professional conduct, that she breached her fiduciary duty, and her violations led to unfixable damage. And one is left to wonder if the violations could occur again, maybe not with a passport, but maybe with money or some other property. The public must be protected, and again, without an appreciation for the violation, passing years mean little. The quantum of discipline to be imposed has ranged the whole spectrum in this case. The district presenter sought a one-year suspension. The panel found for a two-year suspension. And then the DRB voted 4 for censure, 3 for a 3-month suspension, and 2 for a reprimand. Each of the cases relied upon by the DRB and now endorsed by the respondent dealt with escrow money. And in many of those cases, there was a reasonable belief or disputable basis that the money should be released, which is certainly not factually on par here. The gravity of what was being held by respondent in this matter makes it that much more serious. Certainly money is serious. but respondent a veteran practitioner, so renowned in her area of practice, with the lack of a reasonable dispute on the release of the passport, the lack of unqualified remorse, and the fact that the harm caused was so great, so much more important than money, requires a quantum of discipline to protect the public and preserve public confidence. And that discipline, the OAE respectfully suggests, is a 3-month suspension. And with that, if there are any questions, I certainly will do my best to answer.
No questions. Is there anything you'd like to add?
No. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you. Mr. Minter, let me ask you at the outset, this is a de novo proceeding. Is your client amenable to answer questions herself at the conclusion of your remarks?
Yes, Your Honor. And during my presentation, I was going to ask leave of the court for Ms. Marzano Lesnovic to address the issue of remorse. And I believe if there's other questions from this court,
we'll call on her after you're done to speak.
Yes. Thank you. Good afternoon, Chief Justice and Associate Justices. May it please the court. In this matter, the Office of Attorney Ethics has charged my client with 7 violations of the Rules of Professional Conduct. At this juncture, 5 of these 7 violations have been dismissed, and what remains is a finding by the Disciplinary Review Board that my client violated RPC 1.15A and RPC 1.15B. And as we know, the DRB determined that a censure was the appropriate quantum of discipline. My client comes before this court today humbly to accept that level of discipline. And we submit, given the substantial mitigation that exists here, that the DRB's determination should be upheld by this court. I'd like to take the opportunity briefly to highlight the mitigation that exists in this matter, and of course address specifically any questions that the court may have. This court has long emphasized that the central purpose of our system of attorney discipline is not to punish the attorney, but rather it's to protect the public and preserve confidence in the bar. Here, I respectfully submit that the mitigating factors once considered by the court demonstrate that the DRB appropriately satisfied the central purpose of our disciplinary review system, of our discipline system, excuse me. And I'd like to just briefly highlight the mitigating factors, and I'll go through them as quickly as I can. A mitigating factor that has been recognized time and again by this court is no prior disciplinary history. This misconduct occurred in 2004, and prior to that point, there had been no disciplinary history of any kind. Another mitigating factor that has been recognized by this court is exemplary conduct since the transgression. Here it is undisputed that 18 years have elapsed since the misconduct, and Ms. Marzano Lesnovic has not been subject of any other discipline. Indeed, the DRB indicated in its opinion, quote, respondent has an unblemished history in 32 years at the bar. And as she comes before you today, that's now 33 years. Another mitigating factor that has been recognized by this court is circumstances showing little likelihood of repeat offenses. Here again, 18 years have elapsed, and there's nothing in this record, despite what I just heard from the Office of Attorney Ethics, there's nothing in this record before you that would demonstrate that there's any chance that this conduct would be repeated. In fact, all of the evidence before you demonstrates, I would suggest, to the contrary. Another mitigating factor that's important in the analysis is this an isolated incident and not for personal gain? And again, here, there was no disciplinary history before the incident, none after, and there is no evidence here that what occurred here was for any personal gain to the respondent. Good reputation and character. Here at the disciplinary level, the hearing panel heard from several live witnesses and also entered into evidence 44 letters that attested to the respondent's good reputation and character. Another mitigating factor is service to the community. And I would suggest to this court that Madeline Marzano Lesnovich's service to the bar over her 33-year career has been simply extraordinary. She was the president of the New Jersey chapter of the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers.
She went on to become the president of that organization's national chapter. She was the chair of the New Jersey State Bar Association's family law section. She was a member of this Supreme Court's Family Practice Committee. She received the New Jersey State Bar Association Distinguished Legislative Service Award. She received the Saul A. Tischler Lifetime Achievement Award. Putting all of those aside, I think one of the most important things in terms of her service to the community is the countless hours that she spent teaching, writing, and lecturing on matrimonial law topics over the last 33 years, all to the benefit to fellow members of the bar. Lastly, on mitigation, I would like to address passage of time. That has been recognized as a mitigating factor. Indeed, this court has held, quote, the public interest in proper and prompt discipline is necessarily and irretrievably diluted by the passage of time. And in the context of the passage of time, I would urge this court to consider its recent determination in a matter called In re Hoffman. I believe it came up before the court in 2021. And the facts in In re Hoffman, they're certainly different. It involved the respondent being charged with intentional omissions on a Chapter 13 bankruptcy petition. The DRB there found that the respondent had found violations, including a conflict of interest, conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, and misrepresentation. So conduct arguably much more severe than the conduct here. And the DRB issued a reprimand. And the facts there, but when the DRB issued its reprimand, it did indicate in its opinion some mitigating factors, which are strikingly similar to this case. There, the respondent had a 43-year career without any prior incident. The misconduct, just like here, was an isolated incident. There was a character witness, and there was a passage of time. And in Hoffman, it was 16 years. So thereafter, this court, utilizing its authority to review DRB determinations under Rule 1:20-16, determined, and I quote, the discipline for respondents' established unethical conduct was not warranted. There was no discipline. So when you compare this matter to In re Hoffman, I believe what's charged here, or what's been established here in terms of the RPC violations, are less severe than the fraud violations in Hoffman. There's more mitigating factors here, and the passage of time here is actually greater than it was in Hoffman. It's 18 years here as opposed to the 16 years in Hoffman. So for all these reasons, we respectfully urge the court to consider the passage of time here as a very important mitigating factor to be given substantial weight. I'd like to just briefly touch upon the two aggravating factors that were mentioned by my colleague. And the first is remorse. And that seems to be really an important topic here, and it was referenced, of course, in the DRB opinion. Respectfully, while we come here humbly to accept the quantum of discipline issued by the DRB, we do disagree with the DRB's finding that Ms. Marzano-Lesnovich failed to demonstrate genuine remorse during the District Ethics Committee hearing. And I'm specifically referring to page 73 of the DRB's opinion. They refer to a, quote, utter lack of remorse, end quote. And then they point to the respondent's testimony from the DEC hearing. And the problem is that for some reason, the citation to that testimony is incomplete, and it frankly gives an impression that's inconsistent with the respondent's answer. This is what the DRB said, and again, I'm quoting. Yet, at the ethics hearing, when told explicitly remorse was a factor for the DEC's consideration and asked if she wanted to add to her prior empty answer, the only, quote, remorse, end quote, respondent could muster was to say, quote, this, end quote, she was sorry, this happened to Innes. So I'm sorry to belabor or to go on a little long, but here's the actual question and answer sequence, and I apologize for the length, but it's really this lack of remorse that the OAE is coming before this court and asking to suspend my client for, so I think it's important for the court to hear it. A panel member, and I'm looking at page 220 from what has been referred to in our brief as 8T for transcript, a panel member asked the following question: considering that if there should be a finding that there was an ethics violation, acceptance of responsibility and an expression of remorse and learning can mitigate the consequences of such a finding. Do you have anything to add to your answer about having made a mistake? Answer, yeah. There's a slight interruption, and then her answer is this. I had 5 kids and 9 grandchildren. The thought of not seeing one of them, 4 indiscernible in the record, growing up is horrific. So to think that I played any part in Mr. Innes not seeing his daughter all these years is something I live with on a daily basis. I went up to Mr. Innes after the jury found that I had gave their verdict indiscernible, Mr. Innes, and I said to him, I am so sorry that this happened to you. He thanked me for being truthful without, and again, indiscernible. It's very painful to think that you might have been the cause of someone else's sorrow, especially when it relates to children, who I went into family law because of children. I advocate for them. I write on special needs kids. So I respectfully don't believe that the citation to the testimony gave this court the full answer that the respondent gave at the district ethics committee level that did show remorse. And again, Mr. Chief Justice, as I mentioned in the beginning, I'd like the opportunity, we would request the opportunity for Ms. Marzano-Lesnovich to make a statement to this court specifically on that issue, if the court will allow it.
Yes.
I'm almost done.
I'm not rushing you.
I wanted to just discuss one other aggravating factor that was raised, which is harm to the victim. Here, you know, all these RPC 1.15 cases are all usually about escrow monies. And obviously, this is a completely different factual scenario. And we do not come before this court to suggest that this harm wasn't as severe as it could be. It was. There's no question about it. The harm that was visited upon Mr. Innes and his child was severe. And I think it also needs to be conceded here that providing the passport, which Ms. Marzano-Lesnovich has admitted she did, created a possibility and a foreseeability that the child could travel. I don't think it would be legitimate for us to come here and argue otherwise. But I think in fairness to the respondent here, the context and the unfolding of the series of intervening events that happened needs to be considered. First, there's nothing in this record that would suggest that Ms. Marzano-Lesnovich conspired in any way with Ms. Carrascosa. It was Ms. Carrascosa who, by the way, was a licensed attorney who absconded with her child to Spain, an act that she knew had to be illegal. She then kept her child in Spain in the face of and in violation of numerous court orders. She was then indicted and spent 6 years in jail rather than return her daughter to the United States. And finally, Spain, a NATO nation and a signatory to the Hague Convention, sidestepped its obligations to return the child to the United States. And that's not an argument that I'm making out of whole cloth here. That was a finding from 2 federal courts and our appellate division. So, look, the harm here is clear, and Ms. Marzano-Lesnovich is not running away from that harm. It's devastating harm that occurred, but we're asking this court in fairness. We're not asking you to ignore that harm, but we're submitting that the confluence of these intervening and unforeseeable events that we've identified clearly aggravated that harm beyond anything that Ms. Marzano-Lesnovich did. Finally, I want to just conclude with the quantum of discipline. And it's our position, as I said at the outset, that the quantum of discipline recommended by the DRB is amply supported by past precedent here. Typically, in these RPC 1.15 violation cases, the result's either an admonition or a reprimand. And I think the theme in the case is clear that the distinguishing factor between whether you go with admonition or reprimand is the reasonableness of the attorney's belief that the disbursement was permitted. In other words, if the disbursement was judged to be unreasonable, then the baseline discipline becomes reprimand. And this is the theme throughout the cases. So here, the DRB, relying on In re Landis and In re Holland, to come to its recommendation of a censure, found that the disbursement was unreasonable. Hence, the baseline was reprimand. And I think, and I would submit to your honors, that In re Holland is really most on point. It was a matter with an RPC disbursement violation, and reprimand was the outcome. And there was a finding, of course, that the release was unreasonable and the explanation given for the release not credible, just like the DRB found here. In Holland, though, there were violations found for much more serious things as well, including disobeying an obligation under the rules of the tribunal, conduct prejudicial to the administration of justice, and record-keeping violations. So there's five violations in Holland versus two here, and they're more severe, and Holland was a reprimand. So we would submit that Holland is the right way to view this case. The OAE cases that they've cited where suspensions resulted are all distinguishable from this case, frankly. Most of those cases, the violations were more serious, and there were aggravating factors present. I'll give you just a quick example. They cite Hasbrook. Hasbrook, there's six violations versus two here, including a lack of candor. Chambers, seven violations, including lying under oath. McDuffie, two prior reprimands and a temporary suspension at the time that the respondent came before the court. So here we submit that the DRB's reliance upon the line of cases resulting in discipline below a suspension, such as In re Landis and In re Holland, was entirely appropriate and consistent both with the facts in this case and the mitigating factors that exist here. I thank the court for its time, and I'm happy to answer any questions, or I can bring Ms. Marzano-Lesnovich forward as Chief Justice would like to speak with her or ask questions.
Just a few questions first with respect to timing. The incident and the underlying matter, that took place in 2004, 2005. The meeting with the client was in December of 2004, if I recall correctly.
I think that's correct, Judge.
When did the malpractice case begin, and when did it conclude?
I believe it began in 07, and I believe it ended in 16, and I'm saying that because I think... Yeah, I believe it ended in 16. It ended shortly after the remand from this court.
Would it have been appropriate for the disciplinary matter to have proceeded before then?
No. And
when did it start then?
I think the disciplinary matter, I think it started in 18. And I think the DRB addressed this, and we're not arguing the passage of time that it's somebody's fault. I think the DRB said that too. I mean, there was... Clearly, the malpractice case wound through the courts and took a while. And I think it was both at the appellate level and at the Supreme Court level. And this ethics matter was filed a year or two later.
Thank you. Questions, anyone? Ms. Marzano-Lesnovich?
Good afternoon. Did you want me to speak first?
Please, please go ahead.
I know from years of reading transcripts that it's hard to judge how someone really feels. It's so much easier if you see it in a person's face or hear it in their voice. I can understand that this court reads the findings of the Disciplinary Review Board and comes away believing that I've shown a lack of remorse. But that's really not the case. About this case, every single day. More than that, I think about how my decisions at the time and my actions resulted in a father not seeing his daughter. An inner daughter not seeing her father. This was an unbelievable tragedy, what's happened, that I had a part in causing, when that haunts me. There's not a day that goes by that I don't wish I had done things differently. Why did I let Miss Caracosa leave my office with the passport? Why did I put so much trust in her that she was telling me the truth? Was it because she was an attorney? I don't know. In retrospect, I think that that probably influenced my thinking that she was trustworthy, that she was telling me the truth about the letter agreement that they had. Why didn't I call my adversary and see if he agreed to my understanding of the events and what I was about to do or what I did? Why didn't I call the predecessor and try to get a better understanding from him? I don't know. I wish I could go back in time and make things differently, make different decisions. Decisions that might not have resulted in Mr. Innes not seeing his daughter. I am so very sorry that my conduct resulted in this horrendous tragedy. And it will live with me for the rest of my life, just as it has lived with me for these past 18 years. Just wanted to say.
Anything
happy
else?
To answer any question.
Would you like a glass of water first?
No, thank you.
Sure. You need a moment to compose yourself. I had a couple of questions.
It doesn't
two
get
questions
any better.
To assess the appropriate discipline, we need to consider, of course, the very points that your attorney presented in very fine fashion, and also have an understanding about the scope of the conduct, the misconduct that took place. Can you tell us in your own words how it is that your client ended up walking out of a meeting with you with her daughter's passport?
Yes. I had gotten the file. She came in. We were reviewing parts of the file. I had the file before that, but I hadn't reviewed it all, except when she came in. We had a meeting scheduled, a settlement conference. I invited Mr. Innes and his attorneys to come to my office so we could talk about what to do. And Ms. Caracosa came before they got there to talk about it, to go over the file and answer any questions I had. Her mother and father were there. They were lovely people. There was a letter agreement prior to my representing Ms. Caracosa. And I read it, and she told me that it had been rescinded, that she had sent an email rescinding her partner. The day, I think it was, she said the day after it was signed. The letter agreement provided that Mitch Leibowitz, who had been the predecessor attorney, hold her U.S. passport, and that the Spanish passport was lost. The daughter had dual citizenship. And that he had 20 days to get it back. It was long since past 20 days. And I asked her what they were doing to get it back. The letter called for Mr. Leibowitz and Ms. Caracosa, as I remember it, to have done some stuff to try and get to find or get a new Spanish passport. I don't remember the exact details of it. And I asked her, and she said, no, you know, he never did anything like that. And in retrospect, it's true. He had never done anything like that. Tried to get that or question her about it. And she said, I have the passport. I found the passport, and the Spanish passport. So I thought, well, if no one was after the Spanish passport, which was part of the agreement, I think, and it's hard for me to say what I was feeling back then. There's been so much about it since that I don't know if I'm influenced by other events afterwards. But it felt like she had custody, de facto custody. There was no custody ruling. There was no complaint filed. Mr. Innes had left the marital home. He left the child in her possession. And it's kind of always been an unwritten law in family law that the person who has custody has the stuff that's the child's. And she had the Spanish passport, and she picked up the passport from the file, and she said, oh, that's my daughter's passport. And she showed me the picture of her daughter to show me what her daughter looked like. And I said, oh, yes, it is. I didn't say, take this, it's yours. I was more focused, truthfully, on what we were going to do at this meeting. The other issues that she was raising about Mr. Innes and the parenting time they had agreed to, which wasn't happening. And that's why I had called for the meeting to see what safeguards we could get in to assure Ms. Caracosa that her daughter would be safe with her husband. I was going to ask him, and I did ask him, to get drug tested and hair follicle. I think I asked him for the hair follicle test too, but I don't remember. And then as it turned out, it got later and later, and I went out to the reception, and Ms. Caracosa said, well, if they're not going to show up, because it was past the time when they were supposed to show up, I'm going to leave. I want to go home. And she did. I think her parents had already left, or maybe they were in a different room. They may have waited for her, I'm not sure. She left. And about a half hour later, Mr. Van Olen, who represented Peter Innes, showed up, and I went out to the reception room and I told him my client left because you're an hour late, and she didn't wait. And we had tried to call him, but we only got a voicemail, a recording. And he got angry and he said the appointment was for 12. And I said, no, it was for 1. And I showed him our confirmation that it was for 1. The appointment was for 12, not for 1. He said he thought it was for 1. And I said, let's reschedule it. And he was angry. And we didn't talk about anything because he was angry. Now, in retrospect, I should have said, wait, while you're here, let's talk. And she said, how come nobody did what they were supposed to on the Spanish passport? Do you know that I gave her the passport? I let her take it. Do you know I'm not listed as the person holding it? It's Mitch Leibowitz by name as the person who is holding the passport. Mitch didn't ask me to hold it or anything. I should have sat down with Peter Van Olen. I wish I had. I wish I had just said, look, get over the anger. Here, have a cookie. Sit down and let's talk. And I didn't.
Before we get to that point where Mr. Van Olen is upset, as you've just described,
yeah.
Can you tell us in your own words what, if anything, you did that was wrong?
Oh, I should have. Once I saw the passport in the file, I should have grabbed that, even if I showed it to her and she said to me that was my passport. I should have made sure that I didn't let anything happen to that until there was consent of everybody. I didn't know. I didn't learn until the malpractice trial, during testimony, that Mitch Leibowitz and Peter Van Olen spoke to each other and that Peter Van Olen was advised that Mitch was giving me the passport. Nobody told me about that. I wish I had pushed. Today I would know better. I would push. I would say, no, you got to talk to me, you got to tell me, etc. And I wouldn't let anything out of my sight until I had made sure that I had all the facts, that I knew if people thought I had an obligation, if I had an obligation.
You were familiar with the agreement itself, which said...
I had seen it when she... somewhere between her retaining me, which was on November 17th, and I think the first meeting that we had with Mr. Innes and Mr. Van Olen was supposed to be like, I want to say like December 10th, something like that. When the file came, which it didn't come right away, I had seen, my recollection is that I had seen the letter agreement. Maria Caracosa told me that it was had all been rescinded the day after. And
were you familiar with the language in the letter agreement that is critical? That passport needed to remain in trust and was not to be handed over.
I don't think that's what the letter agreement said, but I don't remember, truthfully. It's been so long.
Neither Ms. Caracosa nor Mr. Innes may travel. To that end, the child's United States and Spanish passport shall be held in trust by Mitchell Leibowitz. Mm. You were aware of that?
I was aware of it at the time, but believed that the agreement had been rescinded.
And your belief was based on what your client said to you aloud during that meeting?
What she said to me at the one or two times before, like that meeting was a long meeting. The other times, I don't know if it was on the phone or meeting with her. I'm not quite sure I remember. She had said to me it was rescinded right away and that at some point she showed me an email that she sent Mitch Leibowitz saying that agreement does not work for me.
You've argued before, you and counsel representing you, of course, have argued to the DEC and also to the DRB that agreement was repudiated. That was
yes,
part of
that
the defense.
Was my belief.
Do you still stand by that belief?
No. I believe now that I based my reliance on that agreement I based my belief that that agreement was repudiated on Ms. Caracosa, and I should have called Mr. Van Alen, called Mr. Leibowitz.
What has changed? What has changed since you believed? Well, let me back up. If the agreement was repudiated, as you believed for a number of years, then consistent with that, you would have believed you did nothing wrong, right?
Right, right.
So what's changed since the years that you stood firm with that belief and your statements to us today?
A recognition that I couldn't rely upon that, that I didn't do enough to find out that that was true. I believed that it had been repudiated. I believed my client. As time goes by, and you know, I'm questioned about it, and people argue with me about it, or the Office of Attorney Ethics says what they did, or the presenter, and everything, I see that I just didn't do enough.
You have a situation, you have a hotly contested divorce.
There was no divorce filed.
I understand.
Yeah, there was nothing.
An acrimonious relationship between your client and her.
Yeah, my client was accusing the father of.
You have a child with dual citizenship. You have recognition based on reviewing the file, or at least the file would tell you that there is a lot of concern about this child being taken to Spain and never to return.
Only that letter.
Right.
That letter agreement. That was the only thing. And plus my client had told me that the child, who I think was 4 at the time, had traveled. They had been married in Spain. Her parents lived in Spain. They had traveled multiple times. The child had attended some nursery school in Spain.
I understand.
And that they wanted their child to be brought up.
I understand. But now they're consulting with divorce counsel. As a matter of fact, before you got involved, they're consulting with divorce counsel. And it's to the point where there's a attorney trust agreement that passport stay in the attorney's custody, which indicates there's some concern about your client absconding with this child and taking her out of New Jersey and taking her out of the United States. And she then says, I want, oh, that's mine.
Mm-hmm. I thought since she had the Spanish passport and could travel on the Spanish passport, and since nobody brought a court action, nobody did anything saying, hey, get the Spanish passport. I didn't think it was the issue of that. I mean, I thought this was a child that would go back and forth, you know.
Even though the agreement expressly said neither may travel outside of the United States with the child without the written permission of the other party?
Mm-hmm. Right. I figured when she was going to travel outside the United States to take the child home for the holidays like she wanted to, we would just get permission. That's why we were having this meeting. You know, even when we did have the meeting the following week, I said to Mr. Innes, I understand that you want your child to be raised internationally. And there was, yes, we want her to, she is of Spanish descent as well. And, you know, there was this acknowledgement that was later, a grant at. That was later, a week later.
When she told you, I have the Spanish passport.
Yep.
What, if any, obligation did you believe that you had under the agreement?
Well, since I thought the agreement was repudiated, I didn't think I had an obligation at the time. I have since realized that I should have been on the phone. You know, what I wish we had done was just taken the passport, tell her, bring me the Spanish passport too, let's get it all turned over to the court.
In your experience, have you had cases in which you were holding passports?
Yes.
In trust, okay.
Yes, I've had cases before where we held the...
Where there were agreements?
Yes, absolutely, but the difference, it was always a court order. I never was involved in a case where a passport was involved that didn't have a court order. I mean, my practice had been to run to court, you know.
Here you knew that there was an agreement. We've been over that. Here you knew there was an agreement.
Yeah.
What was the context in which your client told you on several occasions prior to that meeting that the agreement was repudiated? Because I know you said there were a lot of issues that you were going over with her.
Right.
So for what purpose was she telling you that it was repudiated? That she wanted the passport?
No, because this really had to do with her daughter in parenting time. The agreement had provided for some parenting time between mom and dad. You know, they had said some parenting time. My client said that her husband was dating somebody else and having them sleep over. And she didn't want her daughter in there. And her daughter had come back saying that, I don't know whether she just said that they... You know, that they took her in, the daughter woke up during the night and they took her into the bed. My client didn't want her in the bed, you know, with the girlfriend and her. But I don't remember if that was right before or after. She said that her daughter came home smelling of marijuana and that Mr. Innes had introduced the daughter to his girlfriend saying, "This will be your other mommy," something like that. So my client was very, very concerned, and we were very concerned with the parenting time issues. And there was a provision in the agreement that the child wasn't supposed to be taken beyond a certain distance. And my client said that Mr. Innes was constantly taking his daughter beyond the distance. And I forget what the distance was.
So were these conversations in order for her to seek to revoke the agreement? I'm just trying to understand.
I'm sorry, what?
She tells you that the agreement was rescinded. The agreement that includes all of this, all of these terms and conditions with regard to parenting time, with regard to the passport,
yes,
with regard to travel.
Right. And
but
she didn't
she's telling you that... She's concerned with all these things, but at the same time telling you that the agreement's been rescinded. Did you look for any documentation in the file or from your client that the agreement had actually been rescinded?
There was the file, okay, couldn't have been more than a quarter of an inch thick.
Was there anything in there that showed
there
that it was
rescinded?
There
was an email from my client to Mr. Weibowitz saying this agreement would not work for me.
But not between Mr. Leibowitz and Innes' attorney.
No.
If you have a binding contract.
Pardon me?
And you've practiced a long time and obviously very well renowned in your field. If you have a binding contract and a day or a week later, you don't like it anymore. It's not working out so great. You don't get to just rescind it, do you?
In family law, you get to make changes.
To make changes.
Yes.
But there's
unilaterally? No, what happens is...
Right, that your client had an email to her own attorney saying,
right,
I don't like this.
Right.
That
and
doesn't
that's
show
why,
that
right.
there
and
was
that's
a change.
And that's why I invited them to come so we could come up with some parenting time.
And maybe maybe you have a later agreement that's agreed to bilaterally by both parties. But until that happens, there's still a binding agreement between the two lawyers on behalf of their clients. And that was not you. It was Mr.
Right.
Leibowitz, right?
It wasn't me.
And part of that agreement was keeping that passport in trust. So your client may not have liked it anymore. She may have been essentially saying to you, we have to make adjustments in this, but having her say, I don't like this agreement,
granted.
I'm just confused that you would ever think that had any significance
because
whatsoever.
The predecessor didn't push for what was supposed to have been done on the Spanish passport. Mr. Van Alwyn did not push on behalf of his, may I finish?
Please.
On behalf of his client about the Spanish passport. So I thought they all agreed that it was repudiated. Stupid, absolutely naive and stupid on my part. Okay, absolutely recognize that. But that's what I believed at the time. And our focus, and that's why I invited them to the to my office for a meeting, the focus was on the parenting time. That was like the big issue because I said, you can't not have your the father see with the child. You have concerns. I have no proof that this man is using drugs. So let's ask him to do a drug test. Let's have a meeting and let's say, do a drug test or have somebody supervise your parenting time until the drug test takes place. I mean, that was like the focus of this was to fix the parenting time, which is why it's so ironic that what I did caused no parenting time to happen.
For the rest of the child.
Would you just describe for us that you naively believed and foolishly believed your client in the moment? That continued for years. That belief extended throughout the DEC and the DRB proceedings, correct? You continued to say this was repudiated because my client told me so.
Yes, and because I saw the email she sent and because actions weren't taken to that were called for in the letter agreement.
And I take it from that that you also believed for that lengthy period of time you did not need the father's permission before letting the passport out of your office.
Right. And I
do you believe that today?
And I thought, no. Go ahead, no.
So again, I'm struggling to understand what's happened since
what's
the
happened
years of litigation
is,
and today. It's not a, this is not a surprise.
The findings of the local disciplinary action, district ethics committee.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was like, oh my God.
But you if, persisted in front of the DRB, notwithstanding the local
because I was trying
findings.
To explain what I thought at the time. I thought that's what it was about.
I misunderstood your answer. I thought you were saying that the DEC findings were a wake-up call of sorts.
Well, that was a wake-up call, but it was also us being questioned about what I believed at the time.
You mean in 2004 when you say at the time?
I'm sorry, Brian.
You say at the time, do you mean in 2004, not at the time that you were before the
2004
DRB?
And at the malpractice trial. I believed that I did nothing wrong.
You've
I mean, I certainly didn't intend.
We'll take a moment.
Your Honor, may I just speak?
If your client wants to finish your sentence,
okay,
of course,
sure.
I'll give you a chance, Mr.
Of course. Yeah.
There's never been an accusation that I did anything intentionally, that I intended to cause harm to Mr. Innes or harm to his daughter.
No one is suggesting that in any of the questions. I take it you understand that.
Sorry, if you repeat the question, I've got a question.
I just said no one is suggesting otherwise.
So during the time In 2004, I didn't think I was doing anything wrong. I had family law experts who said the child's belongings go with the child, okay, assuming that the agreement was not in existence. The expert wasn't allowed in.
If you had a court order, you would never have done this, right?
Oh, God, no.
And you have an agreement.
I was the one who told Mr. Innes's attorney in court in February when Maria Carrick, in February 2005, when Maria Caracosa came back without her daughter, I was the one who told Mr. Innes's associate and Mr. Van Olen, get yourself to the Hague, file a Hague Convention petition right away. No, if there was a court order, God, no, excuse my language, would never, ever, I mean, this is how we operate with passports. We use court orders. I don't know of any other case, and I've been involved in a lot of cases, and I've been practicing many years, where an agreement about a passport is done by a letter agreement. And letter agreements, as my experts in the family law experts whose reports were not allowed in, said, agreements change all the time in family law. It's very fluid. You enter a parenting agreement with someone and you say, the child's going to sleep at dad's house every other weekend. Whoops, child came back. Whoops, this agreement has to change. Child not happy. This is not working well. I mean, they're very fluid. They're not court orders.
Holding a passport in trust is very, very different from the child's going to be at dad's for Saturday night.
Of course.
And that's really serious. Lawyers very are serious. Asked to take something in trust. It's something that all of us take seriously.
Yes.
So I don't think it's... I just respectfully think that it's in a different world than... The following things are going to happen with the child's schedule.
It definitely is, and there's no question about that. It is.
Other questions? Anything else you'd like to add? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Did you want to say something, please?
I'm sorry to come back up. I just didn't anticipate the level of questions, and I just wanted to add just very, very briefly. I opened my comments by saying that the respondent has humbly accepted the discipline that's imposed and the two RPC violations. And I know, of course, the court wanted to understand the context of why the passport was given, and of course, that's the court's prerogative. She's conceded that. And the concern that I have is there was, and I wasn't there at the district ethics committee level or in the legal malpractice case for most of it when it was being defended, but to the extent defenses were raised about repudiation of the agreement and things like that, those were defenses that were asserted by her lawyers at the district ethics committee level, and I know that those were raised at the DRB level as well. I think Ms. Marzano-Lezovich has tried to explain to you what her thought process was, flawed. She's come before here and she's admitted that those are violations. So I don't think admitting to an RPC violation and remorse are necessarily the same thing. I think that she's expressed true remorse for what happened here and the horrible outcome that occurred here. And I think she's tried to explain because she did take positions in the legal malpractice case and at the when she was testifying or when a defense was being presented about repudiation. And I understand that. But we opened by conceding, and that's why she's being disciplined, and that's why it's totally appropriate, respectfully, what the DRB did, which is raise the level because they found some aggravation. The base level for what was done was a reprimand. because there was a finding that it wasn't reasonable to turn it over. And that's what the case law has said when you go from an admonition to a reprimand. And then the DRB looked at it and said, we see some aggravation here. And I think it was mostly, well, it was the two factors that I discussed, which was their finding of a lack of remorse and, of course, the aggravating factor about, the harm that occurred here. I just wanted to just address and just remind the court that the respondent has humbly come here and said, I accept it. And yes, did she defend herself arguing previously about a repudiation? Yes. Yes.
So Mr. Minner, of course, sure. There's nothing wrong with somebody articulating a defense and standing behind it consistently. We're here today to impose discipline based on wrongdoing, to the extent there's wrongdoing. So if there's a question, and this animated some of our questions, if there's a question about what it is that she, in her words, believes she did wrong, that's not at odds with, I took a defense, I no longer stand by the defense. I asked her, for example, do you now believe that agreement was repudiated?
Okay. I wasn't anticipating the questions, Your Honor, and I'm just protective of my client, and it was lawyers that were arguing repudiation and raising legal defenses. And I just want to be fair to her that I think she's come here and said, I did this. This was wrong. I wish I could undo it. It's a violation, and I'm ready to be disciplined. And I just tried to assert the argument that the discipline that the DRB has laid down is the appropriate level of discipline, given all the other mitigating factors that are present.
It's a very fair argument.
Thank you.
We'll take the matter under advisement. Court's in-